Love Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to the rebooting David Gregory show.
No. Come on, get serious.
Well, why should I get serious? That's not my job.
Rebooting the news with Dave Weiner and Jay Rosen.
Okay. We're not rebooting David Gregory. Darn.
Rebooting the news number 49.
49. Welcome back, you know, the next David. One's going to be number 50.
Yeah.
The big 50.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, before that, I'm going to turn the big 55.
Are you?
Ugh, it's ridiculous. Anyway.
At the end of this week, I'm flying out to the Bay Area.
How do you like that? You can have it, Jay. It's all yours.
I know. I'm going to be in Palo Alto where Facebook is headquartered.
Oh, are you going to stop in? Say hello to Zuck?
You know, I have done that before back when Chris Hughes was with the company because I know Chris Hughes a little bit. He was one of the co-founders from Harvard, one of the pals of Zuckerberg who helped found that company. But he's since moved on, so I don't know anybody there.
You know, I saw the presentation that they did last week, and it was the first time I'd ever seen Zuck talk.
Did you watch it online?
Yeah. I watched a live stream of it, and he is something else. I mean, he's even more. I mean, he is a, how to put it? I mean, he is unabashed seeking of power. I mean, he really is unabashed about it, that he's going for it all, and he thinks it's funny. And he giggles a lot during his presentations, and nobody's laughing with him, though, Jay. And he wonders, why is nobody laughing with me? And I could have explained it to him. It's because they all feel, they're all terrified of you. He's not a warm cuddler.
Well, I remember years ago when he turned down $500 million from Yahoo because he had his own vision and, you know, didn't want to sell.
Right.
That's when I started to think, this guy's a little different. This guy's got balls.
Yeah. I wonder what his parents are like, you know? I mean, Bill Gates was the same way. I don't think Bill Gates ever entertained the possibility of selling out. It just wasn't in his... Yeah. You know, it wasn't in his plan. His father was phenomenally wealthy, and his mother was on the boards of major corporations, foundations, charities, and so forth. She knew everybody, and young Bill Gates got that as an advantage. His mother used to go on a lot of meetings with him.
Right.
And I think she actually brokered the deal with IBM, if you can believe it.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, and he got started with $6 million when he graduated. All the Gates kids got $6 million on graduating college.
Well, that's a big advantage.
Yeah.
Zuckerberg grew up in Scarsdale.
Right, well, and that says money right there, right?
Some, yeah.
Yeah, and he went to Harvard.
Did
Bill Gates.
Yeah.
It's funny, I was at Harvard when he was there, and I didn't notice him at all.
How about that?
Yeah, we were doing our blogging thing, and he was doing his Facebook thing.
Right.
Yeah, well, it's weird. Whatever.
Well, I may go, because I was invited to go to PARC, P-A-R-C, when I'm in Palo Alto.
Yeah.
Because I met somebody from there, just ran into her in the elevator in Austin, and she said, why don't you come by and talk to, like, our research scientists, which would be a really interesting thing to do, and I may do that.
It's a very historic place.
Yeah, I know.
But the train left that station a long time ago.
And here's the reason I'm telling you this, Dave. My brother, my older brother, who is a geek, he's a computer engineer, worked at PARC when approximately the same time that the graphic user interface and those things were being developed, and eventually, you know, Xerox decided not to develop them themselves.
Huh.
And he was there. He wasn't in that unit. He wasn't working on that thing. But he had a couple of years at Silicon Valley, and he just didn't catch on for some reason, or it didn't grab him, or vice versa. They didn't grab him. And he went back to Pittsburgh, and he had founded a series of companies as an entrepreneur in Pittsburgh, which does have a modest tech community surrounding Carnegie Mellon. But I always feel like, man, he was so close to to the main event, you know?
Well, there are a lot of, I think we all have that, right? I
mean, yeah.
How close did you get to greatness? And,
right.
You know, what if you, what if?
What if? Yeah, that's what I meant.
Life's filled with what ifs, right?
Well, we have, we don't have to have what if. They did it this week with Facebook and its recent moves. So why don't we go right into that? Because
I don't think they did anything.
Well,
I'm not impressed at all.
Okay.
I mean,
I was trying to provide a neutral summary.
That was not neutral. All right. What you just said, they did it? What, in what way was that neutral? What did they do, Jay?
You tell me.
No, you tell me. I mean, it's more interesting to hear what you have to say about what they did, because these big pronouncements that come out of Silicon Valley are done for the press. They're done to intimidate their competitors and to get their developers under control. Well, that's a secondary or tertiary goal. It's really to blow a lot of smoke at the competitors. And in this case, the competitors were probably 85% was Google and 10% was Twitter and 5% was everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so all that mattered was that Google got pissed and scared, and they surely did. They overreacted. Mm-hmm. You could see it all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And that Twitter got scared, and that totally they got scared. And they all, you know, the mentality of it is that you're supposed to buck up and make it seem like it's no big deal. We got this thing covered. And, you know, the announcements that Twitter had made the week before were certainly in anticipation. They had it, either they had been briefed beforehand, which is a possibility, or they, you know, through the grapevine, had a pretty good idea what Facebook was going to announce. And that's why Twitter did what they did. They went into vapor on their whole, forget what they're called, annotations, I think is what they call them.
When you say went into vapor, what does that mean?
Vaporware.
What does that mean?
I forget who coined that term. It's been around for ages. Well, you know, there's hardware. You know what hardware is. And there's software.
Right.
You kind of know what that is.
Yeah.
Vaporware is made out of vapor. In other words, it's press release wear. It's I write a press release and I make you feel, oh, this thing's very real, right?
Uh-huh.
And you write about it, if Mr. Press Person, you write about it as if something actually happened. And you go on your various podcasts and you talk about, oh, the big words are game changer. This is a game changer.
Right.
All bets are off. The world revolves around fill in the blank. And
paradigm shift.
Paradigm shift. That's a good one. And, you know, we've had a lot of those in the last
fundamentally
month.
Different.
Everything's different now. I mean, you know, but for the next 50 years, that will be blah.
Right.
Yet last week, it was some other guy. I mean, it's ludicrous. I mean,
but wait a second. In this latest round of what you're calling vaporware, it wasn't just the tech press that was writing and kind of agog about what Facebook announced. It was also a lot of bloggers and a lot of people who study the web. And, you know, there's a lot of reaction
like
to
who?
It.
Like who? Who are you thinking
well,
of?
Well, like people like Kevin Marks, people like Doc Searls, you know.
Well, Kevin Marks is a former Google employee who now works for British Telecom. And so what you got there was the Google response.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So you're getting the competitor. Doc, you know, Doc and I more or less see this the same way. In the piece that I wrote today, you know, I think, you know, I got a little bit overhyped myself. I'll admit it. If we had talked about this last week, you know, in the midst of all the hype, I would have tempered it a little bit more than perhaps most would, but I would have got caught up in it too. But what Doc says, and it's totally quotable, worth quoting, is he says that, you know, a big company like Facebook can maybe change the weather for a few minutes, but what we're talking about here is geology, you know, and you know, plate tectonics. And that's really what God does. Mortals don't do that. And, you know, the press presents the guys in Silicon Valley. This is one of the problems that Silicon Valley has, okay, is that the press, and, you know, these days it's a little broader. What you say is, okay, there are bloggers, but they are the tech press. There's, or the business press. They just use different tools now, but they play the same role, and they do an even less thorough job than the business and tech press used to do. You would often get, like, some kind of a comprehensive, you know, thought piece that went in behind the announcements. These days you don't even get that. You just get the bluster. You know, so they tend to get swayed by all of this stuff. But that's a very temporary thing. What they're really trying to do is push around their competitors. And
push around their competitors by announcing what?
That they just took over the world.
By announcing
that's what they announced. They said, oh, the web is just a feature of Facebook now. I mean, this was what our friend Zuck was giggling about up on stage, you know, when he came time to announce this whole thing. He was standing there giggling. Nobody was laughing. And he said, why is it that you guys don't get how, like, oh, they did get what he was trying to say. It's just they didn't like it, you know. And it's bullshit. I mean, to be perfectly honest,
this
is the ocean. You're talking about boiling the ocean. You can't boil the ocean. God can boil the ocean. Human beings could boil the ocean after 100 years of global warming, right? But Mark Zuckerberg can't do it.
All right, but you still haven't said what is it that Facebook announced and why did people react this way?
You want me to say that?
Yeah, okay. I want you to summarize this. I want to hear your summary.
Okay, well, there were a series of things that they announced. First is that like buttons, you know what the like
yes.
command is in Facebook? You just those are going to appear on sites other than Facebook. And so I haven't actually seen very many of them myself. I don't know about you. Have you?
No.
They're out there here and there. However, what people have observed is that when they show up, they often don't work.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's
so
interesting.
That's one of the first signs of vaporware.
Okay, so they announced like buttons right. everywhere, right. whether you're logged into Facebook or not.
Well, no, you have to be logged into
whether
Facebook.
Whether you clicked Facebook Connect or not.
Okay, that's fair, right. But it's the technology that they've used there is well understood, old stuff, mm-hmm. nothing amazing, mm-hmm. you know, and even that doesn't work.
Okay? And what else did they announce?
They announced their open graph, and that was very interesting, actually. There's several parts to it, two major parts to it. One is they want you to put metadata into your web pages, embed that into your web pages, so that if you have a web page that represents a restaurant like Yelp, okay, that they could read the source code for that web page, Facebook could. And they could tell that it was a page that represented a restaurant and that this is the particular restaurant that it represents. That way, if you say that you like it, they know what you're talking about, right?
Right.
Right? And this is pretty cool, actually. And what's even better about it is that data is available to anybody to read. You don't have to be Facebook to read that data. Google could read that data. So while Google might resent the fact that if everybody does implement this, that they're implementing something that Facebook told them to do, net-net, they have to see it as good news because mm-hmm. it's more data and it makes it possible for search queries to provide more relevant information. You know, I mean, you know, although, honestly, I think Google knows when you're talking about restaurants. They can figure it out from reading the text on the page.
All right.
I think they've more or less figured that kind of stuff out. So how much they've actually added to the world is really not that clear.
Unclear.
Number
okay.
one. Number two is if they had asked me, I might have said that's not really the right way to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So they made a call. This is the way they were going to do it. They didn't ask anybody else's
right.
opinion. So a lot of people get upset about that, but you kind of have to suck it in and say, okay, if this really takes off, not bad, not terrible.
That was the second thing.
Right.
Is there
third
another thing?
Thing is they have a interface to Facebook, okay, to the Facebook website, to the data that's behind Facebook that programs can read. Without having to scrape Facebook, okay? So, you know, you understand that Facebook, when you go to Facebook, what you're seeing is a rendering of
right.
that data,
mm-hmm.
A visualization of that data.
Mm-hmm.
The data is actually something separate from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they now have a way for programs to get in behind there and go grab that data. And it was nice. I mean, I said so in my piece that I thought they did a nice job of that. I also wasn't surprised that it was nice because the architect of it is a guy named Brett Taylor, who
right.
was the one of the lead developers of FriendFeed, and their API was fine. I didn't like the fact that they didn't support XML, and
mm-hmm.
And you know, it's I think they should. I think for them, it's a very low cost thing to do. And as a result of them not supporting XML, I would have taken the next 2 days and I would have just spent it. I would have blown off everything except the absolute most important things I had to do, and I would have explored their data set, and I would have had a really good report on what they have. I couldn't do that because I don't have mature support for the format that they chose to use, which is called JSON. And, you know, so in the macho world of programmers, I'm not supposed to, like, admit that I don't have that. But, you know, on the other hand, I'm not the only one. And they made a very deliberate choice. And this really affects trust a lot, you know. And this isn't something Brett Taylor would have done at FriendFeed. He couldn't have afforded to do it at FriendFeed.
Got right? Three things to ask you.
Sure.
I noticed, I'm not sure when, maybe it was a week ago or so, that FriendFeed lost again the real-time Twitter feed. It had it, and then it stopped.
Huh.
I wonder if that was a little sign of these events. That's number one.
Yeah.
Number two is, I'm going to give you my understanding as, you know, a layperson of what Facebook announced. You tell me how wrong I am or right I am.
Okay.
Because I'm not a programmer, and I don't fully understand all these things.
Let's hear it.
But my understanding is that Facebook basically said with this package of announcements that we want to replace PageRank with what your friends say, and relevance will be therefore increased.
That's actually a good take on it. Actually, you know, that's better. I gave you a summary of what the parts are. And you're saying this
the
is
upshot.
What it all adds up
yeah,
to.
Yeah, what it adds up to. Yeah.
Oh, of course. And that's why Google is right to feel very threatened, you know. Yes, this is supposed to be a way for you to get up to the next level.
But very important for news providers, they will own that data.
I don't think so. Oh, good. Oh, Facebook will own the
yes.
data. Oh, yeah. Okay.
The metadata.
I thought you meant the news providers would own the data.
Facebook
no,
will own the data.
Right. yes. It's very important and not very good.
Right.
This goes back to what I've been saying all along. You think these guys are your friends over there in Silicon Valley, Mr. and Mrs. News Industry, and you just simply could not be more mistaken. These are not your friends. You don't even have a seat at the table.
And the reason this is so important is that because the price of online advertising is so much lower, about one-tenth of what it was in print, creating a revenue crisis for the news companies, one of the only hopes they have of getting some of that revenue back is by having really good metadata about their users that might have commercial applications of one kind or another.
Yeah.
Particularly in what's called now in the advertising business lead generation, which is not advertising to people in the traditional way, but being able to say who a likely customer is based on the fact that they visit your news site and you know something about their interests and and their click patterns. So if that data is not actually in the possession of the news companies, but Facebook is the way people access those news companies, they're screwed.
Yes, and they're actively contributing to their own being screwed, their own screwedness. There really hasn't been all that much uptake. If you look at the list of partners that Facebook announced, it was the news industry basically that jumped on board. There was a little bit of uptake from the tech industry, but the really big players weren't present. Amazon wasn't on that list. You got to wonder. I mean, you have to step back, okay, and think who has pages that are objects, okay? Who has, Yelp has restaurants, that's for sure. And I don't know anybody else that has restaurants. New York Magazine has restaurants, okay? But they only have it for New York. Yelp covers the entire United States. Amazon has commercial pages that's worth tons of money.
Book pages.
And they have book pages, but I'm not thinking about the book pages. I'm thinking about the refrigerators and the stereo systems and all, and books too. But and they didn't sign up, and I don't think they're very likely to sign up for this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big hole that Mark Zuckerberg has to fill, and I don't see how he's going to fill that unless, that just means that Amazon would have huge leverage with him. The day that deal gets announced, if it ever does get announced.
Okay, third question.
Yeah.
You said in one of your posts about this, does this loop ever end? What is the loop that you
right.
well, the identified
loop,
there.
Because Facebook's going to fail, Jay. I mean, this is just is way ridiculous. I mean, you know, it sounds good on paper, but when it actually comes time to implement it, the Google just has to get a little bit smart, and they don't have a prayer of pulling this off. Google has to really give up on selling the prowess of their developers and just tell them to STFU, and let's actually start worrying a little bit about delivering features that users care about in this area. And once they do that, then Facebook has some serious hurdles to get over, and they're not going to get over them. If the startup world gets involved here, you know, if we can rekindle that startup world, then Facebook has a whole other set of problems that they have to deal with to get there, because they can't scale the innovation. That's the wall that all these companies hit, that Facebook has not figured out, and they will not figure out how to get around this one, is that as they grow, they're going to be hiring out of the average talent, the general talent pool of the tech industry, and those people are mediocre. And they're going to start doing really mediocre things. What they've managed to pull off so far has been the result of brilliance. And it's wonderful to see that kind of brilliance, but it's in short supply. And as the thing grows, it's going to flatten out, and it's going to get more. It's like what happened to Microsoft. Bill Gates swore he could get around this, but he didn't ever figure out how to get around this problem. And so Microsoft grew and grew and grew, and eventually they started making really bad decisions, you know. And it took a few years after that for it to catch up with them. But it did, and it will. That's why all these things come down to Earth. That's the loop I'm talking about.
Okay.
Is that you get a shooting rocket. Now, what I think, if any of these guys studied history, okay, and really looked to see what happens, what that loop looks like, what the cycles are, they would try to attain escape velocity, I think, is possible. I think you can break the loop.
So what's the escape from the loop?
Is to say I'm not going to grow in... I am not going to be a megalomaniac about this, okay? What I'm going to be is an investor. I see right now that I own a huge piece of the growth of the tech industry. Bill Gates had this situation in the early 90s. He could have looked at it and he could have said, well, I own 40% of all the growth in the tech industry. Nothing can change that. You know, if growth happens, it's mine. Why? Because I own the platform everybody's developing on. Now, I can see the seeds planted, says Bill Gates, that because of this, there are going to be other platforms, because that's what history says. Eventually, I'm going to stop capturing all the growth, and they're going to have to break out. And so what you say is, instead of fighting that, I'm going to go with it and invest alongside. In other words, invest in competitive platforms and stop hiring so many programmers. Those programmers that you hire, they will self-perpetuate. They will make sure that you can't do anything outside of that. They always want to hire more programmers, and they want to hire more programmers. In the Windows, in the Microsoft case, they hired thousands of programmers to work on Windows. They didn't need any of them. Windows, nobody bought Vista, right? I mean, it was predictable.
So that was the result of the mediocre talent pool that is attracted to
right. There was
aging
they don't
monopoly.
Think. They just don't
yeah.
think. What they do
reproduce.
Is they just self-perpetuate.
Yeah.
Every one of them needs more people. They want to become managers. Mm-hmm. So in order to become managers, they have to hire more people. So they have to invent work for them to do. And there's no work for them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just grow and grow and grow and grow. And they chew up all the developer opportunities until the developers figure out how to wrap
so
around
So instead
them.
Of becoming this kind of monopolist, they should become more like an investment banker.
You got it. An investment
seeding
banker.
New
and,
growth.
And they all eventually do become that. Actually, you know, but usually after wasting a 10-year opportunity, they waste a decade in there. And I'm saying is, if you were smart, what you would do is, instead of wasting that decade, you simply wouldn't hire the programmers in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You would put a cap on growth,
mm-hmm.
and you'd say, I'm going to fund the growth outside of my company. And I'm instead of getting the diminishing share of growth that Microsoft gets now is why their stock price is so depressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not getting 40% anymore. Google's getting 40% of the growth. That's really what they traded. Had Microsoft instead anticipated that there would be a Google that would come along, they would say, great, let me put money into you and let me help you develop your market whatever way you want to. Okay, want our help. If you don't want it, that's fine. I just want to own a big piece of what you're doing. And that's what they're doing with Facebook right now. Microsoft owns a big piece of Facebook, mm-hmm. you know, relatively speaking. And in a way, Facebook owns Microsoft.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this enough.
Jay,
I wanted to ask you, had a first experience with the iPad a week ago today.
Yes.
Did it make an impression on you? Did it leave any kind of impression with you?
Yes, the impression was simply that the touch screen is a completely different way of operating the computer. And it's not natural to me, but I can see how it's a potent shift almost psychologically between the machine and the user. And you know, even those goofy videos like the one you pointed to and others did about the cat.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then there's the one, the kid, the baby.
Well, that's really interesting. You have two kids.
I do.
Have they
played around with it.
What did they think?
They played with one in the store. They were both intrigued by it. We're not getting it for them. But they were definitely both intrigued by it, and it probably would be more natural to them.
They're not so young, though. I mean,
they're 8 and 12.
Right.
Yeah.
I think for younger kids, it's
younger kids would probably be even more potent. Yeah.
Well, Scoble has a toddler and an infant. The toddler is just goes crazy over it. Yeah.
Yeah. Touch.
Yeah.
You know, is so much different than manipulating symbols in the front of your brain.
Yeah.
That's my overwhelming impression. I'm not going to get one and. Immediately, I may eventually, but I'm certainly continuing to follow the news about it, and I'm particularly interested in, you know, this whole savior mythology, because I'm not so much connected to the device itself, but that form of thinking that something is going to come to save us, you know, is part of the pathology of the news industry right now. So those are my main impressions.
So should I do it again next time I get a device? Should I bring it in just
sure.
throw it at you? Okay,
yeah.
I'll do it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about fact checking. You want to go? Want to go there next?
There's an update on fact checking, which this continues to spread. It's probably the most viral idea I've introduced into the press, simply in terms of the momentum behind it. And this week, two events occurred that were kind of interesting. One is a couple of college kids just started this site, Meet the Facts. They bought the domain name, and they started it in order to pressure David Gregory to do essentially what Jake Tapper has done and start fact-checking his guests. And I didn't know them. They were readers of my posts and followers of the discussion. And they've been pretty energetic. They've really been on top of it. They've been generating a lot of coverage for their site. And it simply exists to insist that Gregory, as the market leader in this category of the Sunday shows, should in fact do this. So that's kind of interesting because I had nothing to do with it, you know? The other thing that happened is that Sunday on his CNN press criticism show, Reliable Sources, the Washington Post's Howard Kurtz, who's about as mainstream a media critic as you can get, been on the beat for over 20 years, decided to introduce his own fact-checking the Sunday show's segment, which went on to fact-check each of the Sunday shows from the previous week, and he had something to say about each one of them. And he did credit my idea at the beginning, which was nice and thoughtful of him. So he had previously expressed his support for this idea. He thinks it's a solid thing to do, and so he just sort of tried his own version of it, which was interesting. The thing that I'm looking for is whether the pressure on David Gregory will keep increasing and whether we'll eventually get him to reverse his policy. I don't think he will, but it's not totally predictable. So anyway, those two things happened, and I thought I'd update our listeners on it.
What did you think of Kurtz's fact-checking?
Well, the fact that he kind of had to do one per show, whether or not they were equally necessary, was a little worrisome for me, because that's kind of an artificial constraint, you know, one per show. What if there's two outrageous statements on one of the shows, or one of them is, you know, much worse than the other? So I think what he may run into in doing this week to week, if he continues to do it, is CNN's absolute addiction to The View from Nowhere and advertising how impartial they are, and maintaining this kind of formalistic and phony equivalence between left and right and Democrats and Republicans, which has become part of their identity, but is also hugely in the way of them progressing to any kind of more aggressive outlook on politics and fact-checking. And I had actually a go-round. Unfortunately, it wasn't completely on the record with some spokespeople from CNN this week, trying to find out if anybody at CNN had ever responded in any way to Jon Stewart's critique of them for simply leaving it there. And that this critique is that CNN is a problem, because when people say things that are factually untrue or wildly distorted or simply absurd, they just cut to the next thing.
Yeah.
And they never follow up. They never challenge. They simply, as Stewart said, leave it there.
Jay, why do you think they do that? I mean, it seems that when somebody's on air with you and they say something that is blatantly untrue, that here's your opportunity. This is should be what you're waiting for. I mean, you know, now you can have some real controversy. Why let them off the hook? Why do you think they do that?
Well, the main reason, it starts with the fact that television time is very expensive. And it is scheduled and segmented down to the second. And part of what the professionals who run television news do, part of what they specialize in, is the smoothly sculpted flow of a television program. Mm. And so if I threaten to disrupt that, that's a problem for you.
And wait, who's who?
Well, let's say any guest who comes on the air,
right,
who will in fact disrupt that smooth facade if you challenge him, tends to be treated with kid gloves, because this is the undoing of the whole network mystique. You see, if I have to sort of call a halt to the program and say, wait a minute, what you said doesn't square with the facts, the most likely result of that is a kind of an on-air confrontation that actually escalates and can't be resolved in a single exchange. It's not like if I challenge you, you're going to, if you're Rudy Giuliani, you're just going to give up. Oh, you got me, right? No, what happens is it escalates and I have to actually challenge you more.
Yeah.
And you may come back with something that's even more distorted. And the operators who are invited on to TV know this. They know there are limits to how willing the hosts are to call them on it, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And they essentially incorporate that knowledge into what they're doing. And the second reason is, this is something I've written a ton about, it never seems to get through though, but mainstream journalists under attack within the culture war that rules over politics today have to continually advertise their innocence. They have to continually demonstrate to us that they are not part of this side or sympathizing with that side, or they aren't on this team and they're not on that team. And it isn't something that they can just declare once. They have to continually project an image of political innocence. And one way you do that is by allowing people to say their outrageous things and just going, okay, well, for the opposite view, we turn to, right? But right there, now, you're...
Right, and so, but there
you're
was
caught a, in a cycle.
Thread this week, I think, I forget, you pointed to it, where somebody wrote a really passionate piece where they said that CNN should side with the truth. I think that was more or less what...
That was the, Time Magazine's television critic, right?
Right, so yeah. Could you say, well, I mean, I didn't... That,
well, I, his view, James Poniewozik, who's a very smart, sharp, television critic, his view is that what CNN should do is side with the facts, with the truth as best it can find it, regardless of whether it comes out equal or not. And this, in other words, instead of just leaving it there, go on to say, essentially, who's bullshitting us more? Which is what I want them to do. But they won't do it because they can't meet their innocence quota at the same time, is basically what it is. This is the threshold they won't cross. This is the boundary that they go right up to and won't step over. And that's why when Kurtz does his fact-checking thing and it's just sort of one from column A, one from column B, here's a distortion that one of the...
I didn't find his fact, the things that he caught them on were the trivial things, not the substantial things.
Well, that...
It was sort of like, you know...
An artificially balanced fact check isn't worth anything. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, there you go. And that's Howard Kurtz for you. I mean, you know, that was a very polite way of saying what I was thinking. And,
It's a problem.
Jake Tapper, however, looks to see... He seems to be a bit different. No, I mean...
Tapper deserves a lot of credit
just
for doing this one simple thing.
Right.
And it really shook up the status quo.
Now, how does this violate the innocence thing, this whole fact-checking thing? It breaks the rule, doesn't it?
Right, because PolitiFact.com, which is a unit of the St. Petersburg Times... which is a newspaper that happens to be owned by a trust rather than a company. Mm. It's got an unusual ownership structure, sort of like The Guardian. The Guardian is owned by a trust,
right. So
is this newspaper. Always been a very high-quality paper in Central Florida, right? So in their own way, they are willing to say, unlike the rest of the press, actually, that was a lie you just told. And they don't feel the need to balance it with going out and finding a lie on the other side. They're willing to take that step, and that is the threshold.
Well, that was a beautiful way of putting it, to go out and find a lie on the other side.
Well,
this is what passes for news, right?
Well, I mean, this is what I call advertising your innocence.
Well, what's interesting about this is that it's the blog, what we used to think of as the blogosphere, which I don't think of as the blogosphere anymore, suffers from exactly the same thing. I mean, they have people, just the having of certain people on their program meets the requirement. It isn't necessary to actually provide any information. That's why you could have Mark Zuckerberg get up there and give this talk without the questions ever coming up is like, well, to what extent is this implemented? You know, what happens if I dive in the next level in this stuff? Will it actually work? That's something that does eventually come out, but it doesn't make it onto Tech Meme. Tech Meme, you know, has always presented itself as being algorithmic, but it's not. It's human edited, and the things that make it on there are things that fit in. If we could quantify exactly how this filter thing works, this innocence idea works, they're doing exactly the same thing. What they don't want to do is they don't want to piss off the people that the Rudy Giuliani's, who in this world is Mark Zuckerberg.
There's a deep tension between truth telling and advertising your innocence.
And that's why the users in all these situations have some power here that it would be nice to see them exercise.
And I wanted to bring up a point about that. I was reading a lot about this series of changes that Facebook announced because I wanted to understand them. So I was jumping around, and my friend Josh Young provided me with a bunch of links to do that, and I was reading them over the weekend. One of them from Read Write Web was kind of analysis of what these changes would mean for companies, for developers, for users. And at one point, the writer did something that I'm really attuned to, that I really also object to, and that is, he starts to talk about the users, and he says, well, the users probably won't actually notice any of this, and the users just want to communicate with their friends, and yeah, it's invading their privacy, but you know what? They've given up so much of their privacy anyway that they probably won't protest. And this move interests me a lot. What happens is that an observer who is relatively well-informed, right, whether they're a blogger, a writer, somebody who works in the industry and is writing a post, a journalist, they split off the people who are reading them from the other people out there, right? The users who are not as sophisticated. And they begin to make statements about those other people, treating them not as fellow users, not in solidarity with them at all, but instead beginning to regard them as sort of like the masses, right? People who can
That's why I don't like crowdsourcing. That's why I don't like that term.
I know you hate the term crowdsourcing.
Well, it separates us. Doc Searles covered this too. You should read his post about this.
I did.
Oh, you did? Because he went back. This is what was, it's exactly this. This is very important what you're talking about. He went back to the hailstorm announcements in 2002 or 2001, because now we know how that all turned out. That was 8 years ago, right? And so found exactly that, okay?
Right.
Is that, okay, the users are getting screwed, but you know what? You know, that's not our job to worry about that.
Right. Or right? They probably won't care, or they're uninformed.
But ultimately they did. And, you know, and because that this gets felt in the market in different ways, because things like Hailstorm don't get uptake. They don't get adopted because the users can sense a locked trunk. I don't want to get in there because I don't think I can get out. Mm-hmm. Once I'm there, you know, once they're educated on this stuff, but they do go for things that leave them, give them the freedom. You know, this may sound a little self-serving in a way, but I really don't make any money off of this. But RSS was not given much of a shot in this time frame. It did not get the big press. You know, Hailstorm gets this huge press saying this is the way of the future. Had you gotten up and stood up and said, well, no, actually, it's going to be RSS that's the wave of the future, they would have laughed at you. They said, well, where's the corporate bluster behind that? I don't see it. You know, there's nobody willing to get on TV to lie for it, right? Mm-hmm. But yet the users picked that. They went for that as opposed to the other thing. So this assumption that the users are stupid, now, you're just not tuning into the way they express themselves, and they'll do it over and over and over again. The web was a perfect example of that. You know, you had this whole mess, complicated mess of press and venture capital and investment bankers and stockbrokers and the whole nine yards. All this investment made in this idea that the destiny was set in Silicon Valley. Well, actually, it was being set in CERN at that time, while everybody was so sure that we have the handle on how this stuff works.
90 seconds.
It wasn't working that way.
This moment where the analyst splits himself off from the people out there, that is also the beginning of what I call the savvy, right?
Well, yeah.
Because the savvy is the person who can tell.
That's the loop, Jay. That's the loop.
In other words, yes.
it gets blown up, but then it all starts rebuilding again, okay? That's the loop. Mm-hmm. It will probably blow up. Maybe sometime they'll get smart enough, not in the savvy sense, but in the real sense, to find a way to either prolong it so far that it doesn't loop back. Probably it won't work that way. And then it'll blow up, but it'll reform right away.
Prevent this is to realize that a blogger or a writer is just a heightened case of a user.
Absolutely. That's why I named my company in 1988. I called
Userland.
That's correct.
Yeah.
You got it.
Right.
Because, and that's, you know, I mean, and look at, anyway.
That's why I named my philosophy public journalism.
There you go. We see we're two smart mofos. And we're almost out of time, by the way.
Dave?
Wait, I just want to get one thing in. Our Thursday thing, what we figured out is we're studying New York bloggers. That's what we're doing.
Great
idea. The whole city. We're going to understand how blogging works in New York City.
Idea. I
Great
love
lab,
it.
Biggest Ten city seconds. In the United States of America.
Live experiment.
You got it, baby.
See you next week.
Right on.